When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
And welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by Madison Teachers Incorporated, Madison Firefighters, Local 311, and Madison Teamsters, Local 695. And by the way, we want to congratulate Barbara Becker, their longtime office manager. After 42 years of serving the Teamsters, she has retired, and we wish her well in retirement, Comrade Nichols.
We do indeed, man. 42 years.
42 years, and one of the great champions for workers during the struggle against Act 10 and Right to Work.
Exactly. And in fact, it's interesting that the Teamsters, who do represent some public employees, but who are primarily a private sector union, were one of the first to throw in big. And, you know, they were there with trucks and people. And, you know, I remember, I still get a good chill whenever I think of a positive chill down my spine, whenever I think of all the private sector unions that stood up early on and recognized what the fight was about.
I have never heard a president of either party speak this way. This is President Trump the other day.
The system is full. Can't take you anymore. Whether it's asylum, whether it's anything you want, it's illegal immigration. Can't take you anymore. We can't take you. Our country is full. Our area is full. The sector is full. Can't take you anymore. I'm sorry. Can't happen. So turn around. That's the way it is.
Wasn't he inviting people from Norway to come to America not all that long ago?
Well, it's pretty clear there's, you know, that his vision of the word immigrant might be a little different than that of some of us.
Mm.
Yeah. And, you know, like some folks are just like neighbors who've been away, whereas other folks are, you know, horrifying threats. But that statement actually led me to another thought. Has Donald Trump ever been to North Dakota?
There's a lot of room.
I was going to say, you know, you and I, because of our odd penchant for enjoying the great expanses of America, have spent a little time on the road. And
yeah.
I can tell you, I remember once I was out reporting on a presidential race, and I had an editor. It was great. This was years ago. He said, why don't you go to a place where no presidential candidate has ever come? And so we decided we picked the panhandle of Oklahoma.
Oh, Guymon. Sure.
No. Guymon's a big city, man. We went to small town. Boise City out in the
far. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Boise City, where they had a huge rock. It was, you know, like good foot and a half across, right? Hanging from an incredibly thick chain about 2 feet off the ground with a little sign that said, if this rock is swinging, we are experiencing a tornado. So they, you know, good humored, interesting folks out there. But what I remember about this, apropos of the president's statement, that I drove from Liberal, Kansas, mm-hmm. down to Boise City,
uh-huh.
and I literally went. You know, it's a very pretty good sized distance. Two things notable: one, can't get anything on the radio. Two, didn't see another car. You know, it's a pretty interesting thing when you drive, mm-hmm. like 50, 75 miles, and maybe, you know, every half hour you'll see another vehicle.
Right.
And so my point being, I really think there's some space out there.
Yeah.
And here's the final thing I'll say.
By the way, they call that area the High Plains because yeah. they're quite high, and even though it's the plains and flat, it's the elevation is quite high.
Physically very beautiful,
mm-hmm.
by the way.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah. So one final thing about it, though. When I got to Boise City,
uh-huh.
the hotel I stayed at
uh-huh.
was run by immigrants from India. And
this wasn't a Ritz-Carlton.
It was, I think it was aspiring to Motel 6. And the kid who was like helping at the counter was wearing her Boise City Bulldogs t-shirt. She was going to high school, right? Part of the community. for dinner, guy I met down there was ran one of the tractor dealerships. Took me to. He said, "We got a bunch of great Mexican restaurants in town. I think this one's the best." And we went and we had dinner with Mexican immigrants who had opened up a great restaurant. And so, in this small town, in this tiny town, out far from power and far from anything, you saw immigrants who were keeping things going, actually revitalizing parts of Main Street. And my point to our dim-witted president is that, A, there are places that need immigrants, that benefit very, very much from the arrival of immigrants. And some of these places are the places that elected him president.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Well,
but he's just wrong.
You know, one of the things that he did that didn't get a lot of attention is the Obama administration was dealing with the problem of what to do about El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. And they made it possible for people to declare refugee status or to apply for it in their home country. So they didn't have to make that trek. The Obama administration ended that.
Yeah.
So this little crisis, they've helped right along it. When he cut the aid off to the three countries, I thought to myself, he is trying to blow this system up so he can use this as an issue because he wants a war.
Do you think, you mean Donald Trump? Do you think he would exploit immigration?
Yeah,
issue?
I do.
Boy, sly.
We're talking about people's lives here. You know, sending people back without giving them an ability to make their case, in some cases, is sending people to their death.
Well, and let's put a fine point on that and help people to understand that Donald Trump, by the chaos that he seeks to create, and by the way, you know, like what he's doing right now to Homeland Security is, you know, just fostering even more extreme chaos. But the chaos that he is trying to create may be, you know, a political strategy here at home. What it doesn't begin to understand, frankly, our media has a role in this as well. What it doesn't begin to understand is that when you say that you're sending people back to their deaths, in some cases, there's politics on the ground, right, and all sorts of other factors. But there's also something else. When someone makes the choice to believe in the dream of coming to America, they take their chance. These are often folks who have very, very little, and they uproot themselves from what minimal security they have to make this trek to America. If you send them back, you are sending them back without resources because they used the tiny amount of resources they had to come north to a place from which they have uprooted themselves. So it is not, you know, it's not easy to go back. So when we talk about sending them back, whether it's to their death or to horrific circumstances, what we're really saying is somebody made a bet on America. They believed in the possibility of America, as my ancestors did, as your ancestors did. And we've rejected them. And thus, because of that faith in America, they will go back to a situation where the chances for survival are dramatically reduced. We need to understand that. It's why we need comprehensive immigration reform. And it's also why we need to understand, you know, why some of this instability exists. You know, you're talking about Guatemala, right? If you look back at our history 50 years ago, what was the United States up to in Guatemala, Sly?
Not much good.
No, it's destabilizing governments, right?
Right.
And so we have historically, under Democrats and Republicans, created chaos in countries in Latin America.
El Salvador, death squads.
Oh, you know, just run across the region, right? But Guatemala really took it bad. I mean, literally destabilizing of a government, a moderate, relatively moderate land reform proposal was enough to, you know, get the U.S. way on the wrong side of things down there. End result is that chaos that we created long ago continues to destabilize and undermine and render dysfunctional countries that that really could have done a pretty good job if we'd helped them. This remains the case even today. When Donald Trump talks about cutting off aid to all the different Mexicos, if you'll recall.
The Fox News graphic. Fox. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah. When they talk about cutting off aid to these places, what they're doing is continuing a circumstance where instead of wisely, thoughtfully trying to promote stability and some sort of, you know, economic fairness and functionality, creating a chaos that is guaranteed, Sly, to send more people coming our way.
Which makes me wonder whether some of this is deliberate.
Well, whether it's... Here's your choice, Sly. It's a simple choice. Either you're dealing with a very bad person or you're dealing with a very stupid person.
Oh.
And you may choose.
Do I have to split the hairs on that one? Orange hairs on that one? Do I really?
I
do know this. By all accounts, the reason he purged Homeland Security, which is a big department with a lot of responsibilities, is people weren't willing to break the law for him.
Yeah.
They weren't willing. They literally weren't willing to declare the U.S. law invalid and stop people from declaring refugee status.
Can you imagine?
And by the way, I think calling somebody who's willing to take a bullet for you Dumbo because his ears are large is probably a stupid idea.
Oh, my gosh. It was stunning. I mean, that's another issue altogether, right? And which we could discuss at some length. But
he's in his 70s, and he's behaving like maybe a fifth grader?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe high school's a little. But understand this. Think about the firing moment, right, for the head of Homeland Security. And you say, you know, you've been accused by our critics of lying to Congress on our behalf. You've done unimaginably horrible things on our behalf. You've explained away and made excuses for and advanced policies that, you know, are globally recognized as awful, like truly cruel and inhumane. But, you know, we're just looking for somebody a little more terrible.
Yeah, so that's the, you know, USA Today headline. Donald Trump chomping at the bit to bring back the detention policy that separated children from parents.
And to, you know, this thing of closing the border, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you something. A few days ago when he was talking about closing the border, right, literally shutting the whole border there, I know why he was told he couldn't do that. You know, Donald Trump hates when he is told he can't do something, right? I know why he was told he couldn't do that. And he was told it by Republicans who know about politics. I mean, that was the point at which people like even Mitch McConnell were starting to, you know, rouse themselves from their
slumber,
from Trump-defending stupor. Because if you close that border, do you know what the political effect of that would have been? What would the primary political effect of that have been?
Well, you would have shut down the car industry.
Car industry would have been incredibly devastated. Not what I'm talking about. Talking about agriculture, American agriculture. Huh? It would have been American agriculture, which has already been severely battered by this president, would have been devastated. The National Farmers Union and other groups were saying, you know, literally, alert, 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 this is disastrous, immediately disastrous, and then worse over time. And here's the bottom line. If he had closed the border, he would have absolutely lost the presidency in 2020. It would have shifted a sufficient number of farm votes to take battleground states away from him. And he was told that, I'm sure. I don't know. I wasn't in the room, but you've got to bet this political calculations are. And yet he hated it. Because He's not able to do what he wants to do. And I will tell you that this president will continue to try and find a way to do that. And there will continue to be Republicans who say to him, you know, this is devastating. This will do us tremendous harm. And it's going to be a very fascinating thing of whether his political survival obsession, which clearly drives an awfully lot of what he does.
It's keeping him out of jail.
Yeah. Whether it can overcome his I want to do what I want obsession. And this is a very fascinating moment. And the most dangerous player in that mix is Stephen Miller.
Nice man. Nice
Stephen
man.
Miller tells him to do what he wants to do, no matter what the cost.
Which is why he still has a job. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. We'll take a break. It's LiesOffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
We're back at SliesOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works, also Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. All right, let's talk a little bit about what's going on, and not only in Wisconsin in politics, but the Democratic primary. We had a Supreme Court race that you and I have not discussed yet, but I had a strange feeling. I stayed in Appleton a night in mid-March, and I saw ads for Planned Parenthood, all right, talking about reproductive rights and how bad Brian Hagedorn's down on that issue. And I thought to myself, that'd be kind of like the NRA running ads in Madison going after Lisa Neubauer and the Second Amendment. Doesn't really seem like it's very wise. Well, it turns out it wasn't very wise. The piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that Craig Gilbert wrote the other day about the shifting patterns in Wisconsin, they're still shifting. And it isn't just one side that's shifting. The demographics are, and the density divide are amazing. And now people in Supreme Court races are voting just like they do in partisan races. You may remember in 2003, John, that Ed Bruner won all of northern Wisconsin, and Pat Rogensack did very well in Milwaukee and Dane County. She didn't win Dane County, but I think she actually won Milwaukee County. Boy, are we in a different world now, because Bruner was the liberal and she was a conservative.
Yeah, and you actually trace it back to precisely the right point, because it was in 2002, 2003, 2004 there that everything changed. And this is, it's an important thing to understand. A lot of people think, oh, it all, you know, Trump's the one who's, you know, blown this whole thing up. No. George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were the ones who blew it all up. When they launched their unnecessary invasion of Iraq, a war based on lies and fantasies and obsessions.
Isn't that the war Joe Biden supported?
It is,
yeah.
Absolutely. And I hold to the view. But there's two things I tend to vote on, the death penalty and war. Sorry, I know that they're kind of big. And there's quite a few of these Democrats who have not acquitted themselves well on these issues. I also tend to vote on economic justice. But the important thing to understand is that moment caused a tremendous number of people who had been open to Republicans, open to a middle ground, to say, hold it, I can't, you know, this is unacceptable to me. But it also caused another portion of people to kind of lock into their camp. And you started to see the political parties themselves begin to change, you know, and it was a different kind of voting. What you started to get was mobilization of the base rather than a battle for undecided or swing voters. And I'll just one final thing I'll put on that mix there. In 2004, as you well recall, Russ Feingold ran for re-election to the U.S. Senate against a well-funded conservative opponent.
Former Army Ranger.
Yeah,
right?
Quite capable opponent. And it was a pretty aggressive campaign with some negative ads and all stuff like that. But at the end of the day, Russ Feingold was re-elected at the same time that George W. Bush was reelected nationally. In Wisconsin, you had an extremely close result because, for the presidency, because it's a battleground state. There's simply no question of that. It has been for a very long time. But in the Senate race, Feingold won, you know, his, I believe, I mean, am I right about this? You remember better than I, his biggest victory.
Right? It was. Yeah.
He won by...
I think he and Bush both won the 27 counties mutually.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So a ton of people voted for, in that, they could still do it then. They could still vote for George W. Bush and Russ Feingold. That's pretty much died, right? And Feingold saw that reality 6 years later when he was defeated for re-election. What we have come to understand is that the argument you make for your election, the argument that you're a good person who's ready to govern, to do the right thing, as Lisa Neubauer, I think, tried very hard to do, tried to run in many ways a very traditional campaign, is not as powerful in mobilizing as the argument of, you know, I will deliver for you in whatever office I receive what you want. And that was essentially the argument that at the end Hagedorn made. And the important thing about the Supreme Court race is this. Let's just go to Lisa Neubauer's home county. You were talking about the Fox Valley. That's also quite relevant, Southern Fox Valley here. But let's go to Lisa Neubauer's home county in Wisconsin, Racine County. She, her family's deep-rooted there, well-known. And she got about 15,000 votes, roughly. In 2018, when Rebecca Dallet, a progressive, won a Supreme Court race, Dallet got around 15,000 votes in Racine County. Dallet's opponent got, you know, roughly similar amount. Racine County very closely fought county. So this year, Lisa Neubauer held what Dallet had. She basically held her ground and was solid. But 6,000 more people voted for Hagedorn than voted for Skrenet. So you understand what I'm saying there, is that in key places with a very, frankly, very smart mobilization based on an argument that Hagedorn was being attacked for his, frankly, very extreme views on a host of issues unfairly, that he was being attacked as a Christian, I think you saw an incredibly effective mobilization. And that's to be, it's something that people need to understand.
Well, so
Hagedorn was a huge
flawed
candidate.
So when we hear someone, you know, make offensive comments the way Hagedorn did, the instant reaction among, you know, the great political players and minds in Milwaukee and Madison is, that's outrageous. We think everybody's going to think that's outrageous. And we make that the issue and we try to disqualify that person. Now, this has happened twice now. Rebecca Bradley and Brian Hagedorn. It has failed spectacularly twice.
Yep. Yep.
And
when it shouldn't have.
Well, should it have been the issue?
No. I mean, look, here's how do we most effectively talk about someone who has views that, you know, at the core, I think a lot of us think of as cruel, you know, as mean. We talk about them as cruel and mean. You don't talk about them as
Well, I think I know where you're going. They shouldn't have ventured into the school. When they ventured into a school and the Christian education, and then you start hearing the word, you know, the way kids are brought up at a parochial school, they probably didn't need to do that. His verbiage about bestiality was just mean. And I don't really think most Wisconsinites. I don't even think most Wisconsinites would want the government to go in and arrest people for loving someone. That seems like a bit of a stretch these days. Let me ask you about Ron Johnson's reaction to this election. You may remember our friend Dylan Brogan, who's now with Isthmus at the time. Back then he was with WTDY. He covered a story back then during the recalls that Ron Johnson had said that people were being bussed up from Chicago to vote in Racine. Remember when John Lehman beat Van Wongard?
Right.
And, of course, he could never back that up. Well, listen to Rojo the other day.
three of recounts in Wisconsin. First of all, I think the local election officials do a really good job, have pretty good controls over the system. So there have never been very many votes that, change one way or the other in a recount. My big concern is that somebody, all of a sudden comes up with 10,000 more ballots. I'm highly concerned about that. Every day that goes by when that doesn't happen, I'm less concerned about it. But if she wants to waste money in a recount, I would be really surprised if it overturned the election.
So Emily Fanlon didn't ask any follow-up questions there. I think I might have asked Senator Johnson, really, you just said that our clerks do a wonderful job, and then you said you're worried about 10,000 votes coming out of nowhere to swing the election. Well, what gives you that pause, Senator?
Yeah, and then you could have asked him, do you think they might come out of Brookfield? Look, the fact of the matter is he's right about the core concept, right? A couple of core concepts. Number one, that our clerks do a good job. We have pretty well-run elections in Wisconsin and pretty well-trained folks. Number two, that recounts don't usually change a lot of votes, although I will note, Sly, that even in 2016, when Jill Stein forced that recount of the presidential, you did have votes shift, right? Recounts do find votes. You have challenges and pushes back and forth. And so recounts are valuable, in part because they tell us that we can have confidence in a close election result. So I'm all for recounts. I think they're great. But he's right. They don't shift a lot of votes. So two things he's right on. And this is so typical of Ron Johnson. After he's gotten a couple things right, he has to get something wrong. And in this case, he plays an ugly political game. The suggestion, just thrown out kind of almost casually, that those who disagree with him are, can't really be trusted. You got to keep an eye on them. And every day that goes by, I feel a little more confident that they're not going to try and steal, effectively. Say, steal this thing, come up with 10,000, fake votes or something like that. And so it's a very bad game, and it's sort of, in many ways, it's why Ron Johnson, really since he's come on the political scene, has consistently practiced some of the ugliest politics we've seen in Wisconsin, and yet he does so, in this sort of, soft-spoken, casual way that he doesn't get called out on.
Well, I know where he dredged that out from. There's still a lot of distrust that absentee ballots from Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, were counted last. But the truth is, Governor Walker's team went and checked those ballots out, and it was copacetic. You can bet if there had been something smelly about that, they would have been objected to. They weren't. And yet, because it came from Milwaukee, many conservatives have tried to push this notion that there's something illegitimate about Tony Evers' victory. It's very cynical. Mm-hmm. It's a very cynical thing. And when people already have a lot of, trust issues with institutions of government, this only exacerbates it. All right, former President Obama was speaking in Germany the other day. This is what he said.
I do worry about sometimes among progressives in the United States, maybe it's true here as well, is a certain kind of rigidity where we say, I'm sorry, this is how it's going to be, and then we start sometimes creating what's called a circular firing squad, where you start shooting at your allies because one of them is straying from purity on the issues. And when that happens, typically the overall effort and movement weakens.
Do you remember in 2008, did he criticize Hillary Clinton?
A little bit. Sometimes effectively, too. And here's the problem with that, okay? Barack Obama is a very smart man. He's a smart guy.
He's smart enough to be very rich.
Well, smart enough. enough to get elected president, the only Democrat since Franklin Roosevelt, twice with over 50% of the vote. You know, so give him, his political skills are real and, mm-hmm. and to be credited. And in a moment, in the moment when he ran smart and well and effectively. I will note, by the way, that when he was in concerned about the 2012 reelect, what did he do after Occupy Wall Street? He went and gave that speech in Kansas, which actually veered toward a very populist, very progressive stance.
Well, and he went after Mitt Romney for outsourcing jobs.
Exactly.
The problem is then when he governed, he proposed the TPP.
There you go. But with all this said, so I think he's very smart and very capable. And I
and cynical.
I respect when he speaks.
Well, you know, so does Goldman Sachs. They pay him a lot of money now when he speaks.
So let me offer a notion, though, that goes
above. I'll never forgive him, by the way.
I know.
Because I invested more in him than you did. You told me he was going to break my heart, and he did.
I know. So, with all this said, let's go up to...
Can I say some more mean things about him? Because I really don't like him.
Yeah, I get more of an affection for him, but, you know, again, I didn't fall in love as to the same level. But with all this said, let's go up to 30,000 feet and look at the reality of our politics and say that I understand what he's saying there and take it in, put it, you know, take note of it. Let's take note of another fact. There is nothing more rigid in American politics than centrism. The most lockstep, brutal, rigid, extreme approach to politics is practiced by those who call themselves centrists.
Oh, let me give you the example of one. Neocon Bret Stephens, who's on the editorial board of the New York Times and is right now homeless in the political spectrum, although I can sort of identify with that, excuse me. Here's Bret Stephens.
I think that if Joe Biden is disqualified or disqualifies himself from running over this, the Democratic Party has some serious, serious problems. I kept waiting for another shoe to drop. What I learned is that this guy performs Eskimo kisses and shoulder rubs. And if that's disqualifying in the age of Donald Trump, then the Democrats are moving in a very bizarre direction. But Joe, bear in mind, if Joe Biden does not run, the presumptive front runner is Bernie Sanders. And if that's
correct,
if that stays the case, and I don't think people should dismiss it, because I remember dismissing the idea that Donald Trump was going to remain the front runner despite his early poll numbers. If that's the case, I think a lot of people in suburbia are going to look at the devil they know, the 45th president, and Bernie Sanders, and stick with the devil they know, so that I hope Democrats gain a sense of proportion and reason and keep their eye on the big picture, which is what happens in November of next year, not what happens next spring, and nominate an electable, normal, middle of the country, middle of the road Democrat.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay. I wish we had another hour to devote just to that quote, okay, to that statement. Number one. This guy's a never-Trump conservative, right?
Right.
Okay. These people couldn't stop Trump in the party to which they had committed themselves politically, right? They were total, abject, scorching failures, due not merely to their own unappealing approaches, but to their incredible strategic ignorance, okay? And so, for anybody in the Democratic Party to take advice from a never-Trump conservative, I mean, it's sort of like somebody coming and saying, hey, I was a complete failure in my business. Let me take yours. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, it's like, oh, this might cause the suburbs to turn, you know, against the Democrats. Where did Trump win? He won in the suburbs. It was Republican women who voted for him when people assumed they would not. Their theory was that they just couldn't stomach it. In fact, the polling data shows that suburban men and women gave Trump a pass. And So this notion that, oh, yeah, maybe the suburbs are going to turn against the Democrats. It is true that some suburban areas gave Democrats a little bit of advancement in 2018. That's true. But this is not, that's not where Democrats are going to win this thing back. I mean, Democrats are going to win this thing back with a message that really does appeal to the vast majority of Americans who feel that the economy hasn't worked for them. Not Brett Stevens, right? Not people on the New York Times op-ed page, but people out in the vast stretches of America.
All right.
And so he's giving exactly the wrong advice, but he is giving it from the rigid center, which never, never shows even the slightest respect for somebody who taps into, you know, the genuine concerns of a great many Americans.
All right. Bernie's coming to Madison this week, making a swing through the Midwest, clearly making a statement to Trump that he's going to fight for workers and make a stand in the upper Midwest, and Donald Trump doesn't own that issue. In the meantime, as Biden dilly-dallies around, Mayor Pete Buttigieg is gaining traction. And I, for one, think that Mayor Pete is doing damage to Joe Biden in Biden's vacuum, and he's filling a space there. I think a lot of people think that Mayor Pete is in Bernie's lane. I don't think he's in Bernie's lane, even though I think they share a lot of values. I think Mayor Pete is going to hurt Joe.
Yeah, I think he does. I think he also hurts Beto O'Rourke.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and so it's, you know, look, that's the game. And
Republicans are freaking out about him. Laura Ingraham went on an 8-minute ramp last night, trashing him. But they are, you know, Hugh Hewitt said, you know, he scares me. He goes to church. He knows how to speak to people in the Midwest. There's a conservatism about him in style, and he's an amazing communicator.
Well, here's the bottom line, Clyde. The bottom line is this combination of conservatism in style and, frankly, progressivism, even radicalism in approach, is very, very effective. It's, you know, because our media doesn't actually know how to cover ideology or ideas, and so it covers, you know, style quite often. And the important thing to understand about that is this is a young enough guy to understand that and recognize it, and so he's doing very well. There are a lot of politicians who play by the old rules, and they presume that they can, you know, that they'll just be smarter and better and stronger and that will work. And the unfortunate reality is that the way that our media operates today, that's not always the case. I will counsel, however, that Buttigieg is going to have his moment. There's no question. He is having his moment. But we're looking at a field, Sly, that's now, you know, another guy got in yesterday. Two people have gotten in this week.
Right.
You know, both members of the House. And so we're looking at a field that's going to be so wide. My bet is that you're going to see various candidates sort of spin up and have their moment and then spin down. I think it is important to look at the people that are frankly being very steady and focused in their approach. One of them is Bernie Sanders, who each week kind of brings out a new, stronger message. This week, an incredibly strong message as regards labor rights and standing up for unions. And I would also point to Elizabeth Warren, who week in and week out comes up with really strong, powerful proposals. My bet is, now I know that Warren and Sanders, you're talking about Buttigieg, you know, kind of eating into some of Biden's turf. I think Warren and Sanders tend to, you know, obviously be in some similar territory. That'll get sorted out. The bottom line is, I think that the American people have a better judgment, a better sense of what they need than a lot of the media does. And so we will see various candidates spin up. But I will tell you what Bernie Sanders is going to do on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, going to Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and then, by the way, with plans in short order to go to Indiana as well, is laying down a marker saying that it is possible to win the states that gave Trump the presidency. That's a very big deal, because at the end of the day, again and again, the question I hear from grassroots Democrats and independents, you know, who vote in Democratic primaries and who ultimately may vote Democratic in November, is who can beat Trump. And I think that what Sanders is going to be doing, though the national media will never be able to wrap its head around this, and they're all like, you know, certainly Bret Stephens will never be able to wrap his head around it, going to Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Indiana, drawing great big crowds and delivering a pro-union economic justice message that also intersects with racial justice and social justice. Boy, that's a big deal.
John Nichols.
Going to experience a big deal.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.